The topic for tonight is bodhicitta, the mind of awakening, the awakening mind, literally the awakening mind, but what it actually means is the altruistic awakening mind, or the wish for awakening for the benefit of all living beings, the wish to help all living beings realize complete awakening. And this is what defines a practitioner of the great vehicle, the Mahayana. This incredibly wonderful wish that is very mysterious how it arises. Shantideva, the great Indian teacher who is one of the greatest celebrators of this mind of awakening, has many verses on this, and one thing he says is, whatever joy there is in this world all comes from wishing others to be happy, and whatever suffering there is in this world all comes from wishing oneself to be happy. That's a very strong statement, I think. And I think it's very strong because often the way we habitually think is the exact opposite. We're on a very deep level, often thinking of our own happiness and contentment, and as practitioners, that may be in the form of like thinking about how our practice is going and how am I doing in my practice, and wanting to make progress in my practice. And yet, if we take this statement of Shantideva to heart, at face value, it looks like even, you know, wishing for my own spiritual progress for my own sake is the cause of suffering. And actually turning that completely and like how can others be greatly benefited through my practice is the cause of great joy. So we can wish at any moment, we can wish for the happiness of others, and not just the happiness of others, but bodhicitta's, you know, the wish for the greatest possible good for others, which is their complete freedom from suffering. which is their awakening, their Buddhahood. And we can, you know, we can come up with that wish in any moment, maybe, in a somewhat contrived way, or very contrived way, or maybe it's like not even at all. As soon as we start to think about it, we're like, I don't even like thinking about it. It's that's just some weird thing from those old Indian teachers. But even if we were to arouse that wish in a kind of contrived way, still, you know, strictly speaking, in the tradition, it's like really when bodhicitta is born is when it's been developed in this kind of contrived way through thinking about it and contemplating it over and over again until that wish is spontaneously born, or arises completely naturally and effortlessly. And that's, they say, the true birth of bodhicitta. And that's, you know, technically the birth of a bodhisattva. A human being becomes a bodhisattva at that moment. So that's maybe kind of a very high standard. We sometimes, we can use the word bodhisattva in many ways, and we can use it for, well, all of us practicing with the intention to arouse such a wish, or even just the intention to practice and be kind to each other is kind of on the bodhisattva path, but maybe like an aspiring bodhisattva. But one actually enters the first stage of a bodhisattva when this wish is completely takes over a person in this natural and effortless way. But this doesn't happen just like out of the blue. It happens after contemplating it for a long time, the benefits of it and the difficulties of living without it. And Dogen Zenji, in our tradition, speaks of the way it arises, and he's a great advocate of this bodhicitta, this awakening, altruistic awakening mind. And he says it arises not from oneself. In other words, you can't just like produce it yourself and create it yourself, and it's not just like given to you by Buddhas mysteriously sending it to you so suddenly you have it, but it's born at the at this like spiritual communion between a person, a living being, and a Buddha. This is term in Japanese, kanodoko, which literally means something like spiritual or intuitive response, like a spiritual response, the way of merging. A spiritual response that is the way of merging is kind of a literal translation of kanodoko. Sometimes translated as mystical communion or spiritual communion. And this doesn't sound very Zen, maybe, if you haven't heard this before. It sounds kind of strange and theistic, maybe, or something. But this is an important Mahayana Buddhist concept. And you could say, well, what is this spiritual communion, this spiritual response, this response to the openness of a living being. You could say that's the inquiry, is a living being that's open to bodhicitta, and then the response comes from Buddha. And then they're joined at that point. And this Buddha is not kind of like a magical being in floating in space or something like that, but Buddha in the largest sense of the word of the harmonious functioning of the universe, tentatively we could say, is Buddha. Right. To say that actually somewhat defiles or obscures the inconceivable, awesome, interdependent, free-flowing functioning of the whole universe. And yet, sometimes we have to say it. So when a limited little living being like you or me is open to that the harmonious working of the whole universe, then this spiritual communion can happen, and this bodhicitta can be born. Maybe it sounds like kind of a far-fetched story, but this is the kind of classical story of the vast vehicle in Buddha Dharma. And sometimes it's said that there's the aspiration for awakening for the benefit of all beings, the aspiration or the wish, and then there's actual awakening. There's the fruition, the culmination of that wish. And Dogen says, if we talk about this initial aspiration for complete awakening, and then we talk about unsurpassed, complete, perfect awakening, Buddhahood, it's like the difference between the light of a firefly and a raging firestorm that can destroy the whole universe. That's the difference between this first little wish and the final culmination of total Buddhahood. Difference between the light of a tiny firefly and the light of the firestorm destroying the universe at the end of an eon. He says, and yet, if this wish is to awaken others before ourself, these two are not different at all. Sometimes said to be three types of the analogies or metaphors for these three types are like the first one's like a king. The king-like bodhicitta is like when one becomes a powerful king and then takes care of all the subjects in the country. You know, like a powerful ruler of a country, and like a Buddha in that way, realizing Buddhahood, becoming the all-powerful king, and then helping all the subjects in whatever way possible to realize their awakening. And that's one version. It's like it from the position of a king. And another one is from the position of a boat pilot or a ferryman that's instead of being the lording over all the people, it's like just steering the ship that everybody else is on, so we're all crossing to the other shore together. So it's like unlike the king who kind of goes first, this is like everyone going together to the other shore. And then the third type of bodhicitta is like a shepherd. And that's like not even caring about one's own life so much, just taking care of the sheep in the pasture and helping them to grow and become mature Buddhas at the expense of one's own life. The shepherd, the really devoted shepherd, just lives out in the field with the sheep and maybe doesn't even have a roof over their head, and they're only concerned about the sheep. And so this would be like taking the sheep across, guiding them to Buddhahood before oneself. And then once they're all completely at peace, then, oh, I might as well go too at the end. So these three are taught, and not necessarily in terms of better or worse or gradations, but just three types of this wonderful bodhicitta. And, you know, but some people might say that one type is better than another. And it's interesting to think about them, I think, because in some ways, you know, logically, one might say that, well, in order to help others realize complete awakening, one would have to realize it first, right? Because how would you know how to guide them if, you know, you could help a little bit, but once they get past your own level of realization, how could you, then you're, you know, how would you know what to do to help them? So in a way that doesn't, logically it doesn't really make sense. And yet that's often the one that's praised the most, and particularly by Dogen, is the one of like, actually, guide the others there first. And they usually don't explain exactly how to do that. Dogen doesn't. But, he seems to praise that one most highly. And I think we can see this as it's the spirit of that kind of thinking. Even if it doesn't make sense logically, it's this wish. It's just a wish. And you could say, well, there's putting the wish into action, and they talk about that too. But the most important part, in a way, is this initial wish. And the wish to put others first, in a way, is like changes our usual mind of putting ourselves first. So even if it doesn't make sense, if we can open to such a wish, it actually changes our own way of relating to the world. And maybe we would, without even trying, maybe we would realize Buddhahood right at that moment even. And then there's the way of, you know, everyone together. And in a way, that's kind of like the middle way between the others of, you know, me first or others first. And something quite beautiful, I think, about this boat pilot way, where it's just, we're all in the same boat going across together, and nobody can go before or after. And, you know, how could there be before or after anyway? On such a boat. So I think this bodhicitta, you know, people have, I'm sure many have heard of before, and it comes up from time to time, and I personally feel like, it's very easy to forget, and when one's just focusing on one's own practice, and which is wonderful in its own way, but to turn this and like, oh, what's most helpful for others actually changes our own practice and kind of lightens our own burden of self-concern. And people such as Dogen say, the way that we can so easily forget it, Dogen says, it's a very fragile thing, bodhicitta. So if you have even like a tiny little bit of it for a moment, you have to nurture it very carefully, take really good care of it, like it's this really precious gem because it's very easily broken or lost or forgotten. I think is interesting too. Because it's kind of against the grain of our usual way of thinking, I think is why it's so easily lost. There's a story about His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who's in Tibetan Buddhism, that really emphasizes this altruistic mind, this bodhicitta, constantly. And the Dalai Lama is, some people feel like, is the embodiment of pure compassion, right? He's even said to be an incarnation of Avalokiteshvara on earth. And the way he, you know, if you've seen him, he does emanate this loving concern and compassion, and the way that he can relate to the Chinese people who've destroyed his country and so on, so acceptingly and compassionately, is so inspiring. And yet somebody asked him, a Westerner asked him, because, you know, Tibetans it would be taboo to ask this, but that's what's so great about Western practitioners, is like, just, you know, you can ask anything, there's no taboos. So they asked him, well, has this bodhicitta been born in your mind stream? Do you have this bodhicitta that is like almost the goal of the practice in a way? Even though it's kind of like the beginning stage of bodhisattva, it's this essential gateway. And Dalai Lama said something like, you know, since I was a very young boy, for the past, you know, 50 or 60 years, I meditate on bodhicitta every day. And it's like one of my main meditations, and I'm like constantly thinking about it. But, even with all that, I haven't actually even like glimpsed it even a little bit. I thought this is, you know, we could either take that as very discouraging. Well, then if he's doing that, then I'm like, why even bother? What about me? It's like, it's hopeless. Or we can take it as an encouraging, and humbling reminder of how awesome this mind is, and how someone like that could continue to meditate on it every day. And I mean, that's an aspiration in itself. And you know, maybe he's just being humble too, and not speaking of it. But I found that story actually moving. And that could be our practice, you know. It's like, I just, the more I think about it, the greater I think it is, and yet I'm just going in that direction, this impossible wish or impossible vow. And just like we recite at the end of the talk, right, these four bodhisattva vows are bodhicitta vows, actually, and they're impossible. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Save them means cross them over to complete liberation, complete awakening, complete Buddhahood. That's their ultimate salvation. And they're numberless, and I vow to save them. So it's impossible, right? But we recite that regularly in the Zen tradition also. So it's there, and it's easy to recite it in a kind of a rote way, of course. But to take those vows to heart in any small way can be quite transforming. Even just, you know, for the moment we're reciting them, and then we forget them again. But and they all go together, these bodhisattva vows. the, particularly these first two, are kind of like this point of beings are numberless, I vow to awaken all of them. And then delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. So in order to accomplish the first, we have to accomplish the second, in a way, or vice versa. In order to end all delusions, we have to awaken all beings. And in order to do that, we have to enter all Dharma gates. We have to, all the gateways to truth. If we just enter like, 84,000 or something, that's not nearly enough. Because they're, boundless. There's infinite Dharma gates, and we have to enter all of them. And we have to become Buddha's way, which is unsurpassable. So it's impossible, and I guess the point is that we can, there's this fine line, I think, of discouragement and encouragement that we can be right on that edge, and it's like, and I think our whole practice life is often rides this edge of like, I can't do it, it's impossible, why even try? And just, I wish I had never heard about this practice. And then they're kind of like, yes, I don't know if it's possible or not, but that's the direction I want to go forever and ever. And and I'll, there's another Zen phrase, something like, falling down 7 times, getting up 8. Something like that. So we just go in this direction, and we just keep going, and we keep making mistakes, and we keep forgetting, and we keep putting ourselves first, and we keep hurting others, and but then we remember again, and we just keep going, and that's our spirit. I also find it interesting that there's so much emphasis on the wish or the aspiration, and it makes sense to me that that there's other practices. Once this wish is born and the thing blooms, then the practices are practices that we can do even before it blooms. Like the classic ones are like the 6 paramitas, giving and virtuous ethical conduct and patience and diligent effort and concentrated meditation and wisdom. So these we can start such practices anytime, but after this bodhicitta is born, those are the practices, then the bodhisattva like steps into those really wholeheartedly and unregressingly. But the emphasis is on the wish, on the aspiration. I often feel in my own practice that if I'm in touch with that wish, remembering that wish for others makes it really big. It gives us energy that we can't really sustain. Maybe if it's just like me and my practice, but like it's not really working, I can just forget it. But if it's bigger, if it's for everyone, then it's like, we can't, even if, well, it is hard and I don't want to keep going, but like, I have to do this for everyone. It sustains us, and it's fuel. I feel like just contemplating it is fuel for the practice, keeps us going. It's impossible to be complacent in one's practice when we're in touch with that that wish and that aspiration and that possibility of complete freedom and how beneficial that would be for everyone. If we're really in touch with it, it's kind of like, well, what could be more beneficial, right? The freedom from suffering for all beings. Is there anything more worthwhile putting one's energy into, really? I could say, well, it's just an abstract idea. But is it, or is this something that actually manifests through our life? just a little bit of inspiration from Dogen on this. He wrote two essays on bodhicitta. Hotsumujo Shin is like arousing the unsurpassed mind, which is another word for bodhicitta, and Hotsubodai Shin, which is literally arousing bodhicitta. And he quotes from the Lotus Sutra, this classic line of the Buddha saying, constantly making this my thought, how can I enable the living beings to enter the truth and swiftly become Buddha? So ever making this my thought, constantly making this my thought, how can I cause the living beings to enter the supreme way and quickly become Buddha? So even though the Dalai Lama may speak of it like this, that it seems so far-reaching and almost impossible for a living being. Of course, when Dogen turns these classical ideas, he makes them like right here in front of you. It's always completely accessible any moment. Maybe difficult to enter it, but it's actually not far away at all. And so in his classic style, this mind, bodhicitta, is not in the self, it's not in others, it does not appear. But after the arousing of this mind, when we embrace the earth, it turns completely to gold. And when we stir the ocean, it at once becomes sweet dew. Henceforth, take hold of soil, stones, sand, and pebbles is just to grasp bodhicitta. And to go exploring the spray of water, foam, and flame is to be carrying bodhicitta intimately. And then he gets kind of practical. So to give away a nation, a city, a spouse, a child, the seven treasures, one's head, eyes, marrow, brain, body, flesh, hands, or feet, is in every case the clamoring of the bodhi mind and the vigorous activity of bodhi mind. To give away all these things, and does that mean like literally? Or does it mean this self-cherishing, holding way that we, my nation. How do you give away a nation? You can't own it in the first place. Even a spouse, you can't really give them away because you don't own them. But it's that spirit of releasing anything that we're holding. Bodhicitta is right there. And this is strong words. One's head, eyes, marrow, brain, body, flesh, hands, feet. We could just say giving them away means letting go of them, dropping off body and mind. The thinking mind of the present is neither close nor distant, and neither of the self nor of others. Even so, if we turn this mind, this thinking mind, to the principle of delivering others before we attain deliverance ourselves, that is the establishment of bodhicitta. And then, of course, Dogen says, to sit zazen in the wholehearted way is bodhicitta. So I could go on, but I'm curious how this is for people hearing about this. So we it's not such a common Zen topic. Yes.
Sometimes Trungpa Rinpoche Rinpoche translated bodhicitta as a genuine heart of suffering. And listening to your talk and thinking, like, why did you choose those words?
The genuine heart of suffering.
Yeah. Yeah. Referring to the intention. Wish to help all beings. And they used to refer to absolute and relative.
Oh, yeah.
And so relative seems like more practical, and maybe the absolute, it was... When Pema would start talking about it, I always felt like I went on, I just disappeared because I couldn't understand what she was talking about. But I think, it's that ineffable thing, and like maybe more leading towards what other people, it's very interesting for me to hear it in a different way, and it's all the same.
Yeah, and the genuine heart of suffering is very interesting, because that's the compassionate heart, is that can genuinely suffer with others, and we feel the pain of others in an uncontrived way, and wish them to be free, is a wonderful way to put it, and yet it's such a surprising way to hear it, because it's a translation of the mind of enlightenment, or the mind of awakening, which is like the mind that's free of suffering. So the mind that's aspiring to, but literally the mind of freedom from suffering, could also be translated as the mind of the heart of suffering. So, yeah. The heart of suffering is the same, another translation for the mind that's free from suffering, according to Chogyam Trungpa. Thank you.
Well, along those lines, the discussion of bodhicitta straddles that line between relative and the absolute. Mm. And we've talked about it before as, if in the concept of nothing outside of this universe, when the liberation of this mind is the liberation of the whole universe. And in Bendo Wa, we've talked
about
that Baroque language, and that section is, this sitting really resonates throughout the universe. And then also, to paraphrase the Diamond Sutra, that the act of saving all beings really is done without the concepts of self or other. Once again, that idea of merging comes up. Maybe we've just had lots of conversations about the absolute notion of bodhicitta.
It seems both halves are important. What was I just thinking? Was it somewhere in Dogen where he... What does he say? He says in one of these two essays, he says something like, sometimes people hear that that true bodhicitta is like non-doing, and it's like kind of, which came up in the Bendo Wa discussions too. And it's a non-doing, non-activity, because it's more, he's like coming from this ultimate place. And he's saying, so things like, building stupas and making offerings to Buddhas and all, that's kind of like, child's play or something like that. And Dogen says, that's like demon talk. Dogen, who often goes to the ultimate, kind of in that case, like came back to the other side and says, if you say it's just non-doing, that's just like that's like Mara coming to tell people to not not, you know, literally benefit beings in the world. So yeah, good point. And yeah, it's always these two sides, the practical, conventional, and then the ultimate. And in a way, the ultimate, like, gives the energy to keep going in the conventional, and the conventional grounds the ultimate in the conventional, in the world, yeah.
Bodhicitta, I was thinking of intention, and then I thought about awareness of an intention, which is different than intention. It seems like intention is in every moment, and sometimes not being conscious of intention, and being aware of in this moment, what is intention? Seems like a different process.
Being aware of it versus trying to change it?
Or just being on a pattern, unconscious kind of intention that just comes up in the moment.
Yeah, yeah. I think if we are aware of our intention, it naturally shifts. And it goes towards the wholesome. I would say always, actually, this is the case, that if we're really aware of it, it never, if we get really aware, like, oh, I was actually like that person, but now I'm really aware, like, oh no, I want to do something bad to them. I don't think it ever goes that way, in truth. I don't know, maybe that's happened to somebody, but it seems like, yeah, by studying our intention, by investigating it and being aware of it, it naturally goes towards the wholesome, and the ultimate wholesome intention would be bodhicitta, or the greatest intention ever, maybe some would say. And I think there is, in our own practice, is something to investigate this, you know, the difference between contriving it, and when is it appropriate to actually, like, you know, like intentionally contrive a wholesome thought, versus, like, I think often the Zen take is, like, you know, don't do that, don't contrive anything, just, like, be uncontrived, is the kind of classical stance. But for example, like, Tibetans are really into, like, mind training. And you actually, you know, which is kind of contrived practice. It's kind of conventional thing of, like, you actually, like, train the mind to think in new ways and intend in new ways. And we have that in Zen too, but I think Zen has the danger of veering into the being so uncontrived that it doesn't change a habit. But maybe that's not quite the right way of saying it. Maybe it's, if we're really completely uncontrived, I think that actually does change habits. But maybe it's saying it's uncontrived when it's really subtle contrivance in a habitual way, if that makes sense.
Digesting this new perspective, I'm thinking it doesn't really matter in which direction the call or the response moves. That it's more like not even two halves necessarily, but a whole event of calling and a whole event of responding, and they seem necessarily to arise together.
That's beautiful. I think that that's great to see, because I hadn't seen that side of it. So to see, actually, just like you say, it's not one or the other, but it's communion, and inconceivable. I think when we look for the inquiry, it maybe really was that the inquiry was first over here, and that this inquiry is coming from a response, and so on. So in the realm of this dynamic, interdependent working of everything, it I think we can't say. There's that image, maybe in the Blue Cliff record, of about inquiry and response of and I don't know if this is a true way that this happens or not, but baby chick trying to break out of an egg, and in the story anyway, the chick is pecking from the inside to get out of the egg, and that's kind of like the student trapped in the shell, and the teacher, or we could say Buddha in this example, a sentient being stuck in the shell, and Buddha, when they hear the peck from the inside, the Buddha pecks from the outside. And does anyone know if mother chickens actually do that?
Mother chickens really do that.
They do that?
Yeah.
Wow, that's cool.
And the impulse comes from within the egg.
Uh-huh. The first, and they can see it or feel it or something. And that's so great. Yeah. So in that case, the impulse comes from the, like, a sentient being or inside the shell. But who knows? Maybe the mother hen's like, when is this thing going to be born? Let's get it going. And the baby, whoop. Yeah, but together, everything breaking the shell. We dedicate the merit of this discussion to the arousing of bodhicitta in all living beings. Beings are numberless.